And you're listening to WHUS 91.7 FM for the next hour. You will be listening to Radio Naturopath. So we do encourage you to participate in the conversation. The number to call is 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. We would love to hear from you. I'm here with my co-host, Ron.
Hey, Franny. How are you?
Yeah. And so do call us, and you can also text us at 860-486-9487. Again, that's 860-486-9487. And you can email us anytime at radionaturopath@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. All right. So it's been an interesting week because I was away again, unfortunately.
Yes, you were.
Yeah. Well, it's a pretty bad bug that's going around. Unfortunately.
Yeah, it's kind of nasty.
Yeah, and it seems like it's a virus, and it seems to hit your weak spots. And depending on who you are, whatever that weak spot is going to be, that's where it's going to get you. And I was so bad that I actually went to the dark side. So I wanted to talk about going to the dark side for a little bit, what the heck that means. So I had started off with a fever, a really high fever, well, pretty high fever, a week ago Sunday. And I had a fever of 99 to 101 for a week. So that wasn't good. That meant that I had some kind of infection that just was going to be real hard to beat. And when you're treating with natural medicine, naturopathic medicine, one of the things I'd really like to point out is that naturopathic medicine is not an us and them philosophy. Because frankly, in life, in politics, and in medicine, us and them really doesn't work. Divide and conquer, as they say. So it doesn't make sense for me to be on the opposite side of what the MDs do, which is why in the state of Connecticut, since our law was passed in 1923, we have not had prescriptive authority, and we've been trying to get it for many, many years. So anyway, when you're looking at what there is available in medicine, you don't want to use natural medicine for the sake of using natural medicine. You want to use what works to help the patient. In general, in my estimation, in my observation and experience, it's a combination of both. So if I'm going to use pharmaceutical medications, I'm not going to be using them alone. So what happened to me was I had a fulminant infection that just kept going on, and it wasn't quitting. And any time I would exert myself, I would feel worse. I'd feel more tired, and I'd feel sicker. Until by Friday, I chose to finally go back to work. And the stress of working made me a lot sicker. And by the end of the day, my lungs were just about closed up. I had pain in my chest. I was trying to breathe, and it was very difficult. I couldn't breathe without coughing. It was getting to be very frightening. So I took myself to what I deemed to be a very nice place, which is the Dempsey Center over here, the Roy Circle. And this is a place where, like, if you need acute care but you don't want to go to the emergency room, your local acute care facilities can be really, really helpful for you. And it just happens that the one here at UConn at Roy Circle, they have great hours. I mean, I went there at 6:45 at night, and they were there ready for me and ready to take care of me, and they were going to be there until 9:00 that night. So I saw a very nice physician's assistant, and also met the doctor on staff, who was they really very nice, friendly, laid-back guys. They treated me very nicely. They were very excited to find out that I was a naturopathic physician and wanted to send me people. So they really made me feel like a rock star. And the guy listened to my lungs right away. He said, "Oh my goodness, that's not good. You've been sick for a week." He listened to my lungs all over, and he saw that I could barely breathe. And the first thing he did was he said, "I'm giving you a breathing treatment right now." So I had never had a breathing treatment in my life. And so you see, there's a thing called a nebulizer. And some of you who've had asthma, you know what a nebulizer is. Maybe you don't. But a nebulizer, what's a nebula? A nebula is kind of it's a Latin word for a cloudy substance. So in space, it's star material that's sort of spread out. And when you look at it in space, it looks like a cloud. Something that's nebulous is cloud-like. So a nebulizer takes medicine and disperses it into a cloud, so it's easy to breathe and it disperses well and it goes into your lungs and it makes medicine and it helps stuff. So he gave me a nebulizer full of albuterol. Now, albuterol is what we call a bronchodilator. It is a beta adrenergic agonist. What that means is it stimulates... It stimulates the neurotransmitter, norepinephrine, and so it puts you into fight or flight. So things that put you into fight or flight are going to open up your lungs. They're going to make you breathe harder. They're going to increase your circulation. They're going to increase your heart rate. They're going to increase circulation to your skeletal muscles. But in this case, what you're looking for when you're taking a bronchodilator is you're looking for that fight or flight to open up your lung spaces. And that's what it did for me. So I sat there, you know, breathing on this albuterol for, and he let me do it for about 15 minutes. And it was the first time I could breathe in a few days without coughing. Like I could actually relax and breathe. It was very nice. So he gave me that. And then he prescribed three things for me. And I'm like, am I really going to do this? So he gave me the old Z-Pak, which is azithromycin. It's a long-acting, high-potency antibiotic that gets into your system pretty quick. And when you take azithromycin, you take a decent dose. You take two pills the first day, and then you take one pill a day for another 5 days. It's what you call your Z-Pak. So I took that. I was given a dose of 4 days of 40 milligrams of prednisone and also an albuterol inhaler. And the albuterol inhaler, he said to me, your lungs are going to be hurting for a while. You know, you're going to still be clearing mucus even after the infection is gone. So, you know, the inhaler lasts for a long time, and he gave me a refill on the inhaler. So still got the inhaler, and so it's really interesting. So prednisone, what in the heck is prednisone? Prednisone is basically cortisone. It's synthetic cortisone. And why would you take cortisone for a lung infection? Well, because it's a great anti-inflammatory. One of the issues with prednisone is it's what's called a catabolic steroid. So remember that the word steroid simply refers to the ring structure in a particular compound. And examples of steroids are all of the reproductive hormones in your body, your estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, the cortisol that you make, that hormone from your adrenals that powers you, gives you that get up and go. Cholesterol and vitamin D all have sterols in them, so they're similar to steroids. So prednisone is a synthetic steroid, and it is an analog of cortisone, one of the forms of cortisol in your body. When you give a high enough dose of that, it shuts down inflammation, and that's why it's given. In naturopathic medicine, we tend to shy away from it because we see it as suppressive. We see it as driving inflammation deeper into the body. So it's concerning. So, of course, you know, I'm here, I'm offered this opportunity to take this prednisone, and, you know, I'm questioning it. It's scary on the other side, I want the inflammation in my lungs to calm down. I know the inflammation in my lungs is pretty bad. So I'm like, you know what? I'll give it a go. He warned me about the prednisone, and he said that it could make you nauseated. So when you take prednisone, you make sure you eat some food, take your prednisone, and eat some more food. And so I was so nervous about being nauseated that I did follow the instructions, and I ate whenever I took the prednisone. I wound up taking it midday on the days that I took it. So I had some part of my lunch. I would eat that, take the prednisone, and when I took the prednisone, I would take a chunk of candy ginger with it. And the first day or so that I took the prednisone, I also downed it with some ginger beer and ginger tea. And I had absolutely no problem with it. It was really just fine. And so I had that, and I had the inhaler, and I had the azithromycin. So when you take an antibiotic, of course, you always pair an antibiotic with a probiotic. When you take a probiotic with an antibiotic, you can just take high doses of bacterial-based antibiotics, bacterial-based probiotics, but your antibiotic is going to kill them. So it's a really good idea if you're taking an antibacterial antibiotic to also take a yeast-based probiotic that contains Saccharomyces boulardii in it, which I did. And Saccharomyces boulardii is great because it can't be killed by your antibacterial antibiotic. So One great way to take your Saccharomyces boulardii, so you remember it, is you take it at the same time as you're taking your antibiotic, because it's not going to kill it. And yet you'll have the wonderful benefits of the probiotic, and you won't get an upset stomach, and you won't get diarrhea, and you won't get the digestive upset the way you might if you took the if you just took a bacterial based probiotic. And now that I'm done the antibiotic, I can go back to taking bacterial based probiotics, and I'll take extra. You know, I'll probably drink some kefir to get my good probiotics on board. Plus, I'll take a high potency bacterially based probiotic pill, and I'll probably continue to take the Saccharomyces boulardii, because Saccharomyces boulardii, in addition to being a probiotic yeast, it's a macrophage, or it's a bacteria, it's a phage. In other words, it goes around and it eats bad guys. So it likes to feast
bad
on
guys.
Yeah, it feasts on pathogenic or, you know, harmful bacteria. So so Saccharomyces boulardii is very helpful in a lot of ways that way. So, and when you take an antibiotic, it's important to make sure you're doing more probiotics than usual for a good week to 2 weeks after you're done the antibiotic, because the antibiotics do a number on your digestive system. If you take antibiotics long enough term, you will get some yeast overgrowth in your digestive system. So it's a good idea to keep doing that. And I'm also consuming fermented foods. One of my favorite things is to get, I like Kevita drink, which is, it's not kombucha, but it's a probiotic drink that I like. It is kind of vinegar-based. It's just not as vinegary as kombucha. So I like to drink that. You could do other fermented foods. You could do sauerkraut. You could do other fermented vegetables. And that will get your probiotics back on board. And then there's the matter of the prednisone, because the prednisone is an immune suppressant. And so the PA was very clever, and he addressed the concern of the immunosuppressive. And he said that he was confident that giving the antibiotic at the same time as the immunosuppressive, that the antibiotic would kill the superimposed bacterial infection, even though the immunosuppressive was on board, and so that would be okay. So what I figure, too, as well, is that when you're taking immunosuppressive and you want to suppress the immune system, so you're reducing some kind of inflammation, and yet you do want an immune system on board, one of the best ways to do that is to consume probiotics, because you have to remember that probiotics are little microcosms. They are little worlds, little entire organisms in their own, they're little, microcosmic organisms of their own right. So they have their own immune system, and they provide an entire immune system for you while you're suppressing your immune system in other ways. And so probiotics are an amazing thing to be taking when you're sick. Probiotics act as an immune system for you, and they make antimicrobial compounds. So one of the best things to do when you're sick with anything, even if you're taking pharmaceutical drugs, is to keep up the probiotics. So the other thing is the immunosuppressive activity of that prednisone. So now that I'm off the prednisone, I'm going to be wanting to support my adrenals, because my adrenals were quieted down. And so I might choose to take some herbs like ashwagandha and rhodiola and perhaps ginseng or eleuthero to shore up my adrenals. I could even do adrenal glandulars to help to support my adrenals, because my adrenals were told to power down for a few days there. And so meanwhile, I'm going to be off the antibiotic, and yet when you have a lung infection like that, especially where he was on the verge of, he wasn't sure if it was bronchitis or pneumonia, that means that there's going to be inflammation and congestion that still remains. And one of the things you want to do is make sure that inflammation and congestion doesn't become infected again. So you still want to do antimicrobial items. So I'm going to choose to take oregano oil. I'm going to try to use the oregano oil to keep the secretions clear, as well as black seed oil. And black seed oil is a wonderful antimicrobial as well. And I'm going to keep doing that. I'm going to keep doing probiotic. The other thing that is lovely to take if you have an infection where you're making a lot of mucus is something with guaifenesin in it. You can go to the store and get Mucinex. I do, when I suggest people go get Mucinex, and my issue with Mucinex only is that, you know, that the pills have, they have tableting agents in them, they have colorings and stuff in them. And also that you don't get something with something, Mucinex with something else in it. When you see DM, so Robitussin also, Robitussin liquid, the main ingredient in Robitussin is also guaifenesin. Guaifenesin is an extract of guaiacum bark. And so it is a natural substance, and it's very benign. The worst you can do is take too much of it, and it'll make you queasy. But beyond that, it's just a mucolytic. It thins mucus and makes it easier to come up. So if you pair a mucus thinner with drinking lots of water, you're going to be able to bring more mucus up. And the more mucus you can bring up and get rid of, the less there is going to be there in the long term to make you more comfortable and make it less likely for you to get another superimposed bacterial infection. And so if you choose to purchase Mucinex, you can get that. It comes with dextromethorphan, DM. I don't recommend that. The DM is it's an opioid, and it's there as a cough suppressant. And you really don't want to suppress your cough because you want to be bringing stuff up. You can also get decongestants that'll have, you know, sinephrine or pseudoephedrine. And I would not recommend those either. When you dry up secretions, if there are microorganisms and cellular material and debris and old proteins laying around from the battle that you did with your immune system, you want to bring those up. So if you decongest, you're not going to have fluid to bring those up. And really what you want to do is enhance your fluid. You want there to be more fluid there, and you want the fluid to be thin. So doing a mucolytic like guaiacum, or guaifenesin is a good idea, and pair that with drinking lots of water. There is another lovely mucolytic that you can take that's natural, and that's N-acetylcysteine, or NAC. And NAC is really great because it's a great antioxidant. It happens to be antiviral. It's detoxifying, and it does thin mucus. So I'm kind of taking both of those as well, and I'm going to keep taking those till I'm not coughing anymore. I have this bronchodilator that I'm going to use as needed. If I'm coughing too much or things are getting tight, I'm just going to use it. I'm going to try to use it judiciously. I get to use it 4 to 6 times a day. I don't know that I'll use it that much. It's very interesting. When you get a bronchodilator, it comes in different ways. It comes such that that you can pump it. The one that I have is a clicker. So you open it up, it clicks, and then you suck out a dose, and it disperses powder into your lungs. Mm. If you can get other inhalers that you push on them, and they push out a dose of, you know, a fume that you just inhale.
Okay.
I think the
powder. I was wondering how that thing worked.
Yeah, I think, but this one I think is better because it's not, you're not in a situation where you're pushing it down, and once the inhaled, the aerosolized stuff comes out, you have to inhale it there because it's aerosolized. This relies on you to suck the powder out. So nothing comes out until you suck it out. So it's efficient. Yeah, so it's kind of nice. So I'll use that as long as I need to. If I don't need it, I won't use it. If I do need it, I will. I'm going to try to be judicious with that. Because it's a sympathomimetic, it dries you out and makes you thirsty, which is kind of a good thing because it forces you to drink. So then you drink more water. So that's the only thing, that anything that's a sympathomimetic that is going to be a bronchodilator for you is going to dry you up because that's what they tend to do. So you have to make sure that you're drinking lots of fluids along with that. The other thing we've been doing is eating lots of soup. Ron's still got a belly thing going on, so salads aren't working for him. And I'm like, you know what? It's cold outside. We don't need to be eating salads. So this is a better time of year to be eating soups and stews and to be getting your leafy greens cooked down. So spicy soup and clear soups. I haven't been wanting dairy. Haven't been wanting creamy. I've been wanting, you know, thin broth soups with chicken. Last night we had that fabulous soup. It had pepper and spices in it and turmeric and
lots of things. Yeah, ginger and it was, boy, I put a lot of things in there. I put everything.
You put maitake mushrooms in there, which are great. Maitake mushrooms are terrific. That's what, you know, also known as hen of the woods. You can collect that around here.
Yeah.
And it's a terrific hen of the woods. It's a wonderful immune tonic. When you cook those down, you're going to get immune polysaccharides that are going to help you with your health. You're going to get immune globulins from the chicken. And then right now you got bone broth going on the stove,
I
right?
I got bone broth going on the stove because I roasted a chicken the other day. So I'm making bone broth right now, and that's gonna brew for at least 24 hours.
Yeah.
You know, maybe longer if I, you know, depends. I might make it roll into the next morning. So I've got that going on, and I also have another batch of turmeric ginger tea going on right now.
Yeah.
So the house smells great.
Right. It's very, very spicy in our house right now.
Mm.
Yeah. And I must say, ginger tea, if you can pound ginger tea and get lots of ginger into your life, ginger is a great anti-inflammatory for the lungs. And just you have to keep pounding it back. And the other thing that I need to do is rest. I didn't realize just how stressful my job is, because I'm so busy. I'm on the whole time when I'm working, and then the tasks that I have to do around the work that I do are so overwhelming, and so it taxes my adrenals a lot. And so if you're sick, you have to be careful of how much you can do. And one of the things I had to do is I really felt like I needed low stimulation. I needed to be very still. I needed to not get a lot of physical activity. I needed to not go out a lot. I needed to really not talk to too many people. I was just overstimulated on so many levels and just exhausted. And
we
so,
just pulled the covers up over you. And every once in a while, I'd take a mirror over and make sure you were still breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah, hold it by your nose.
Just
yeah.
Hung out in bed, watched stupid TV, read some, and really didn't do much else. And I'm still not entirely ready to come out of it. I cut way back on my exercise. I exercised on a week ago Sunday, and I didn't do any, you know, formal exercise again until today.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Where I did my, I did my half hour weights, and I probably will not get on a bike until Saturday.
Well, the bike is hard because this thing is respiratory oriented, so your breathing doesn't come back right away.
No.
And it's, because I've been experiencing that, because I'm about a week ahead of you on this thing.
Yeah.
And it's
and you still got it.
I'm still not breathing right.
Well, yeah. You never.
It's been 2 weeks.
Yeah, I don't think you rested as much as I did.
I rested a lot.
Yeah.
I did. I buried myself under the covers for like 4 days.
Yeah. All right.
So that's a pretty long time for me. That's like impossible for me. But
yeah.
But it's tough, and you know, there's just some really nasty strains of things going on right now. Everybody's sick. It's, you know, I had two people in spin class this morning that were recovering from, you know, illness, and they're hacking and they're coughing. And
yeah, that's a bad bronchitis going around. Yeah. Really likes lungs.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Sure does.
So, I mean, if you have to use, if you have to use MD medicine, you use it in concert with natural medicine and you can get a really good result. And you don't have to feel like, I must use one or the other. That, you know, if you get to a point where things are not turning around, then one of the things about MD medicine is that it, MD medicine works fast. If whatever it's going to do, it may not do the best things for you, but it works quickly. And in some cases, it's really helpful. And, you know, if you don't have the patience or time to wait for the natural medicine to work, or you don't have just quite the right thing, and I had been taking bio-vegetarian, I'd been taking, you know, combination herbal vitamins to keep the infection down, and I was taking a lot of it, and it just wasn't cutting it, and so I needed some help, and it was okay. And this is one of the reasons I want to be able to prescribe, because I want to be able to mix MD medicine and natural medicine, and now that I'm coming off the MD medicine, I'm going to, transition into going back to more natural medicine and just keeping on top of what's going on. All right. So that's what was going on there. I'll let you know about progress, and you should contribute to the conversation. So we'll segue into that for a question from Cole from Colebrook, who has cold hands and feet. So it gets cold up there in Colebrook, especially when you're in that notch in that part of Connecticut, getting up towards Litchfield County, Colebrook and Norfolk, and getting up towards Salisbury and Canaan. That's cold up there because you're in the foothills of the Berkshires up there. And so they get cold up there. It's like the coldest place in Connecticut. So no wonder Cole from Colebrook is cold. So anyway, how do you? So one of the things that we found with this illness is it makes you cold. You feel cold. So how do you stay warm? Well, if you're in Connecticut, there's a number of ways to stay warm. If you didn't already know this, you know, you got to look at your fabrics. If you're being too stylish, you may want to take a look at that. I live in this time of year. I live in these things.
These things.
Well, yeah, thermal right. shirts, thermal shirts. So you can wear the same single layer of shirt. One is thermal, one is not. You will be way warmer in the thermal shirt. And it's really simple. It's just the way that it's knit. It traps air in between the spaces. It makes you warmer. It's much nicer. And then if you take the thermal shirt and you throw something over it, anything, even another shirt. Of course, if you throw something even warmer over it, like a sweater or a fleece, those are other things that are knit and they're put together so that they trap air and they keep you warmer.
You know what we used to call them when I was growing up? Long johns.
Sure.
Right.
Right.
But now long underwear.
Now they're flat fashionable.
Okay.
Yeah. So they come in colors and you can wear them out.
You could get the full suit with the little door in the back and the whole
deal. I was wearing my pajamas last night. I didn't have a door.
You don't have a trap door in the back.
No trap door. Right.
No.
So, I have also found that if I wear wool, you wear wool on your feet, you know, wool socks.
Yep.
You can't live without the wool socks. And I personally like to wear fleece boots. Not everybody does, but I wear a lot of fleece boots this time of year. I found that if I keep my feet warm, I stay warmer too. The other place to keep warm, of course, is your head. And so if you're going outside.
Put a hat on.
Yes, put a hat on. That's simple.
Even if you're inside, you can put a hat on.
Yeah, if you
it
want
works.
To.
It works. It works. Keeps you much warmer. Definitely does.
Right.
Hey, we had a caller who called in and said, fresh eucalyptus leaves in a bath.
That's nice.
If you want to use it to clear your
well, that's another
lungs
thing you
sinuses.
Can do. Yeah, eucalyptus oil or if you have eucalyptus leaves. If you don't have the eucalyptus
right.
leaves, it's very easy to find the essential oil.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something you can absolutely do, a steam inhalation. If you do steam inhalations, you boil water on the stove. You never breathe into a pot that's on the burner. You always take it off the burner before you breathe into it. So you boil the water, take it off the burner, put your few drops of eucalyptus oil in it, and then put a towel over your head. You can also put the eucalyptus leaves, or
mm-hmm.
you can put sage,
mm-hmm.
And you can use any of these as essential oil or as leaves, whatever works for you. And when you breathe the steam in, not only does it open up your lungs, because it has a cooling and dilating effect, but you're breathing in the vapor, and the vapor is antimicrobial. It will help kill stuff. So especially sage and eucalyptus will do that for you. So that's a really good idea. But immersing yourself in a bath with eucalyptus leaves, that's great too, because that's going to be cooling and breathing into it. And if you're in a rush and you don't have time to take a bath, another thing to do is to get a spray bottle and put some water in it and then put a few drops of eucalyptus oil in the spray bottle. And while you're taking a shower, just spray the shower. And you'll spray eucalyptus in the shower, and you can breathe that while you're taking your shower. And that's a quick and dirty way to do it if you don't have a lot of time. So thank you for the eucalyptus idea. That's very nice.
Yeah, it is a nice idea. So I was listening to, not to throw horrible amounts of fear out there, but I was listening to the radio the other day, and I ran across a program that was talking about the deforestation of the rainforests and how because we are, you know, constantly mowing things down and building up, you know, palm groves and pig farms and all these different things that we're putting into the rainforests, we're pushing, of course, that which normally lives in there out towards us more. And they're bringing in all sorts of interesting diseases that we've never seen before. So,
the wildlife is actually
the
bringing...
wildlife carries it, like bats especially are known for it. And they're bringing in new strains of disease that we've never seen before because these are sometimes animals that we've not discovered yet.
Right.
And they're carrying all this. And the problem is, you know, the more you squeeze them out, the more you push them into society. And then the workers that are working on these farms then get infected with them and on and on and on. They were tracing back. That's where they traced AIDS back to this. They traced a few different things that were very surprising. Zika is another thing that they're tracing back towards things like this. So, you know, because we're overpopulating our world and we're trying to get the most out of our very fertile areas like the rainforest, we're actually doing a lot of harm to ourselves.
So that's really interesting. So when you see a season like, you know, this season, I've had three separate illnesses. I have three separate colds. You know, one was a straight up cold that was just in my head. And then I had a second thing that was sort of low grade, but included a bronchitis. And then I had this third thing, which was quite serious. You know, that I, you know, I really, if I had not had, you know, medical intervention, I would probably still be very ill right now. I might be in the hospital with pneumonia. Makes you wonder if you're getting new strains and what you have. You also have globalization. So, you know, if these people, these workers are, you know, they're working in coconut palm fields or whatever, and they're ultimately going to interact with people who are, you know, who are of means, and then it gets into the populations of means. And once it gets into the populations of means, it gets on planes.
Right.
Once it gets on planes, whatever it is, it gets everywhere.
And, you know, this is the real deal. I'm reading a piece right here that is from the Yale School of Forestry.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have the Yale Forest up here. They study forests.
Yes.
And this is all about the rainforest and the problems that are happening within the rainforest and how rainforest loss is leading to rise in human disease.
Wow.
So, yeah, kind of interesting. You know, this is kind of scary. This is why, you know, those that don't believe in environmental activity maybe should take another look at things.
Yeah.
You know, because it creates a problem.
So it just makes me wonder, because I've seen so many people are so sick right now. We, like, everywhere you look, somebody else is recovering from something, and you're just wondering.
Yeah.
When I see that many people get sick, I just wonder if there's a novel strain of virus out there.
Yeah.
That just nobody's seen.
And maybe we didn't get it right. Maybe Australia had something different last year.
Right. Oh, sure. And that
because,
certainly
you
happens.
Know, the flu shot is obviously...
That's
a big, you know... Toss of the balls up in the
air.
They
consider the flu shot successful if it has a 60% success rate.
Ew, just 60%?
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Aww.
Yeah, because, you can't help a virus. Viruses mutate. That's what they do. They're just DNA or RNA in a protein code. That's all they are. They get into living systems. They exchange genetic material, and they mutate. That's what they do. So that's why you have to get a flu shot every year.
So you barely have a 50% chance of staying flu-free by taking the shot.
Yeah, if you get the strain right and you're exposed to that strain, you probably won't catch the flu.
Right.
But
you might catch something else.
You catch something else, but you could also catch... See, the flu isn't one thing.
Okay.
The flu is a virus, and... what we call the influenza virus has relatives. You know that when you go out in Connecticut, you walk around the meadows, you'll see asters, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're all asters, but, you know, this aster's a little purple. This one's a little more purple. This one's white. This one's kind of yellow. This one's kind of pink. They're all asters, and they're all the same genus, but they're different species. So, likewise, you can have an influenza virus... That's not exactly the same species as the next influenza virus. It's going to have a different profile. It's going to have different viruses, different DNA in it. And when they create the flu vaccine, as I've told you, they have to guess about which strain is going to come. And the way they do it is they look at where it's winter, you know, this time of year. So this time of year, it's summer in Australia, and Australia is watching our flu to make their flu vaccinations right now.
Ugh.
But and when it becomes winter in Australia, we're going to look at their winter. We're going to see what strains of flu they have, and we're going to create our flu vaccinations from what strains we see there. But things can change. Things can absolutely change. A few people get the flu. It mutates in their bodies. It's a new strain, and the vaccinations weren't made with that strain, so you still can catch that.
Doesn't seem like a very... scientific way of doing things.
It is
because obviously you're doing this and it does have a 60% success
rate. Well, and you're
rate,
basing but. It on, you, it certainly is scientific because you're basing it on what was observed. But there's not, it's just not 100% success rate. You can't have 100% success rate because there's no way of, you're not going to put, you know, 20 viruses into the vaccine. So you can only pick a couple of strains, and that's all you get to do. And if you don't hit it right, oh well.
I would feel a lot more comfortable if it was a 90% success rate.
Yeah, but that's probably impossible to achieve.
Hmm.
That's the problem. Because, again, the way that you're making the vaccination is based on a prediction by way of the strains that you saw in Australia.
So there are certain people in our society that are more susceptible to having a problem with the flu in the wintertime than others, like elderly people.
Sure.
And people that have illnesses or, you know, long-term,
if you're immune-compromised for any reason, yeah.
Yeah, so they're still best to do this then, right?
As long as they don't react negatively to vaccinations for some reason.
I've seen that happen, too.
That's right.
I've seen people get sick from their flu shot.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Sure, because, and that can happen too. And sometimes people will report, I mean, even though they say, if you got sick from the flu, you're probably going to get sick anyway. That may or may not be true, but it is something that people report, that people get a flu vaccination and then they get sick the next day. And so what's going on there? Is it because your immune system is mounting a response, and a detectable response to the vaccination that you just got? Is it because your immune system just took a hit because it was given this vaccination, which is now expected to respond to, and there was another virus around and you did pick it up and you wind up fighting it? Here's another freaky thought. Could you have been coming down with the flu anyway that you just got vaccinated against, but because you didn't get the vaccination soon enough, you're actually sick with it now?
Right.
So that can happen too. And you can get a virus that's not actually an influenza virus, and because your immune system is down because you just got the vaccination, you can now get sick with this new virus. So that all these things can happen. They can definitely happen. And you do hedge your bets if you take elder syrup every day, if you have an adequate vitamin D level in your body, if you use a neti pot and gargle and wash your hands every day. All of those things are going to help. Using the neti pot and gargling is so simple because the viruses collect in your nose and your throat. And if you're cleaning your nose and your throat out all the time, the viruses are much likely to collect and stay there and you know, make you sick. So yeah, these are all issues. All right, I'm going to get back to how to keep warm.
Oh, yeah.
So we're talking about cold hands and feet. When you have cold hands and feet, one of the things you have to rule out is, do you have Raynaud's phenomenon?
Yes.
So Raynaud's phenomenon is a nasty phenomenon where it's an autoimmune condition, and you may or may not have autoimmune antibodies detectable in your body. But what happens is when you get exposed to the cold, you have a marked inflammatory reaction to the cold, such that your blood vessels constrict and they prevent circulation from getting into your hands or your feet or wherever the exposed part is. And your hands will turn white and they tend to turn blue. And they can be very painful, and you can get numbness and tingling. And if it happens often enough because of this compromised circulation, you can get fibrosis in the tissue, which further messes up with the circulation. So people with Raynaud's, it's very uncomfortable, and they have to be careful to keep their hands warm, to keep warm, to keep circulation going. One of the things we can't emphasize enough is to eat a good complement of spicy food. So whether you're eating cayenne is a wonderful thing to eat. Also, not just spicy, cayenne and beets are both very good because they are vasodilators, and they will improve circulation to all of the areas of your body. So if you tend to have Raynaud's, beets are a very good idea. Beet juice and eating beets, having beets in general, as well as cayenne, because cayenne is warming and spicy. They both are nitric oxide enhancers and will enhance circulation and enhance bronchodilation. They do enhance bronchodilation, but they also enhance vasodilation, and that's what you're really looking for. And then proanthocyanidins. So you're talking about your berries and cherries and their juices, your black currant, your raspberries, strawberries, blueberries, blackberries. All of those compounds have anthocyanidins in it, which are strengthening to the blood vessels. So this will give more integrity to the blood vessels, whereas... whereas the beets and the cayenne pepper dilate the blood vessels, mm-hmm. So all of those can be really helpful. And then cayenne pepper reduces substance P. Horseradish as well; it's nice and warming. So if you have those ongoing, one of the great things about the soup that we had last night, it was a real immune stimulating soup, and it had a lot of spicy stuff in it. Ginger as well; it's another one that tends to be warming. So you can take these in the form of soups or teas, eat them in your food. I encourage not just taking them in pills, although you can get very high doses of cayenne if you take a pill. But I do encourage having them in the food because you want to have the taste experience of heat. And as that goes in, that's going to be yet more warming. I finished my bowl of soup last night. I was sweating. It was very nice.
Yeah. You're welcome.
That was good.
Yeah.
That's
it
good.
It doesn't
soup.
Take much to fire up a soup, too,
no.
If you need to make it hot.
Yeah.
That's a Thai recipe, is what that is. And I use a Thai curry sauce in there.
Was there galangal in it?
Galangal? I don't know if there's galangal in
galangal
there.
Galangal is sort of related. I'm not sure what galangal is exactly. It's sort of, but I think it's kind of like it's a Thai used in Thai cooking a lot. And I don't know if it's... Oh, I guess it's related to ginger. It looks a lot like ginger.
Okay.
I don't know.
It's like
how
a rootish-looking thing.
Yeah. Well, it looks a heck of a... Like, if you didn't know it was ginger, that it was galangal, you'd think it was ginger. Yeah. So it's very similar. And it has similar flavor. And it's nice stuff. It's another spicy... It's another spicy food that you put in, you know, that's used in Thai cooking. We should get some of that.
Okay.
Yeah. It looks like ginger. If you look at the galangal, you're going to think it's ginger. Well, all varieties of galangal are closely related to common ginger and all exhibit some resemblance to the hot, spicy flavor of ginger. Each is unique in its own right, and galangals are not typically regarded as synonymous with ginger or each other in traditional Asian dishes. So it's good stuff.
Good stuff.
I think it's galangal. I don't know. Ginger and galangal are things you're going to put in your spicy Thai soup. You know, that beautiful Tom Kar Gao, those coconut soups, they usually have galangal in them. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, well. Galangal. Yeah, galangal. That's what it is. Good stuff. Yeah. All right. So that's how to keep warm. I wanted to address something with a few minutes left. I want to address for Aaron and Avon, who has AFib.
Oh.
Yeah.
AFib.
Atrial fibrillation. So what the heck is atrial fibrillation?
What is that exactly? Yeah, I know a few people that have that.
So atrial fibrillation, first of all, you have four chambers in the heart. You have the two atria and two ventricles. The atria are the place where blood comes into the heart, whether from the body or from the lungs. Okay, so your right atrium is where blood enters the heart from the body. The left atrium is where blood enters the heart refreshed from the lungs. And then the ventricles push blood out into wherever it's next going to go. So the right ventricle pushes blood into the lungs for purification, and the left ventricle pushes blood into the body for use. So those are their jobs. So the atria are very important. They have to be strong. And one of the ways that the heart is supposed to be functioning, it's functioning all the time. It's beating all the time. And that's the amazing thing about the heart. It never stops going. It has to never stop going, and it has to never stop beating, and it has to beat in a regular rhythm. And if it doesn't beat in a regular rhythm, you're in trouble because you need regular sources of blood to all of your organs, to your brain, to everything that's going on in your body. And so the atria, they have to contract in sync with each other. The atria and the ventricles have to contract in sync with each other. So what can happen, like anything, is, you know, in an electrical system in the house, you can get a short circuit. Well, you can get that in your heart, too. You have electrical wiring in your heart, just like you do in your house. And so you have all these fibers. You have the fibers of Purkinje, and you have a lot of nerves in your heart, and you have a lot of stuff that makes the contraction of the heart happen. And they have to happen in an even way. So what atrial fibrillation is where you have this disordered flow of electricity in the atria, in at least one of the atria, and it makes it so that the heart, the person having it, may have palpitations. The word palpitation is a word that simply means you're aware of your heart beating. If you're sitting here right now and you can't really feel your heart beating, doesn't mean it's not beating. It just means you're not aware of it. And that's the way it's supposed to be. You're really not supposed to be able to feel it. And when you have atrial fibrillation, often you will have palpitations and you won't necessarily. So you could have atrial fibrillation discovered at a doctor's visit, or you may be aware that something is wrong, that your heart, and some people, I had a friend describe it as bees buzzing in his chest. I've had other people say that they feel like there's flip-flops going on in their chest. So why is this a problem? Well, it can cause disordered blood circulation because the heart isn't beating evenly. But more concerning than that is that when the heart is beating erratically, it can cause turbulent blood flow. And you want, what you want when you have blood flow is you want blood flow to be laminar. You want it to happen in even layers and to rush evenly in an even flow. So when you think of a river, you want it to be a river that's just kind of like a lazy river that is flowing at a good clip, but it's not encountering a lot of rapids. It's not encountering a lot of rocks, and it's not causing a lot of erosion. You just want it to be smooth, easygoing flow. And so it's flowing down the river, and that kind of smooth laminar flow is going to make it so there isn't turbulent flow beating against any blood vessels causing any problems. Because once you get turbulent flow, what do you get? You get erosion, you get free radical damage, you get the possibility of blood clots, and you get the possibility of blockages because you get damaged tissue, and then your body wants to go and repair it. So with atrial fibrillation, the big concern is that, the more immediate concern is that you're going to have this turbulent blood flow. The turbulent blood flow can happen inside the atrium, and another place that it's concerning that it can happen is in the valves, because valves have leaflets in them, so it's got these floppy places that it's easy for stuff to beat against, and the valves can beat against each other and they can become erratic. And so if you have this turbulent blood flow, you got blood that's being thrown against these valves, and it can clot. So once you get a blood clot, now you got a blood clot in free flowing circulation. That's a dangerous situation. And if the blood clot doesn't thin itself or get, you know, destroyed by your own antiplatelet aggregating substances in your body, the blood clot can make its way to bad places like your lung or your brain. Once it blocks your lung or your brain, it can block your breathing. Once it blocks your brain, you can get a stroke. So
not good.
So this atrial fibrillation can be very serious. And that's why if it's determined that the blood flow is erratic enough, you got to do something about it.
Mm.
And so...
So what do you do about it?
So, right. So there's a couple of... There's a several pronged... What ultimately you would like is you'd like the bad rhythm to stop. And in natural medicine, one of the first things I'll do is if I hear a heart rhythm that's off, is I'll try to help to regularize the rhythm. And you do that with things that regularize rhythm, like hawthorn berry, like magnesium, like fish oil, like taurine, and like coenzyme Q10. All of those substances can help to regularize heart rhythm. I've had people with irregular heart rhythms take those substances and have their heart rhythm go regular. They don't always stay that way, but if you can use natural medicine to get your heart rhythm into line, then you can be good to go. It doesn't always work, but If it does, that's great. So the next thing that they do is they have to make a decision of how serious they think your atrial fibrillation is. Usually if they decide you have atrial fibrillation, one of the first things to happen is they'll put you on medications to slow down your heart rhythm, to change your heart rhythm, and also to thin your blood. So you'll often be put, the first drug I see people get put on is warfarin.
And warfarin is what?
Very interesting compound. You know what? You know why it's called warfarin?
Because somebody made it up in a boardroom.
So listen to the word. What's the first two parts? Say the first two parts of the word without the in.
Warfare.
Warfare. Yeah.
Okay.
So what does that sound like?
It sounds bad. It sounds like a battle going on.
You got it. And what do you suppose you're killing in the warfare?
Ew. Not really sure where you're going with this.
Warfarin is rat poison.
Oh, it's blood thinner.
Yes.
Right.
That's what it is. And the warfare that you're conducting is against rats.
Right.
So that's what warfarin is.
Oh, great.
And they give it to people.
And they give it to people to thin the blood.
Yes.
Because it thins the blood, therefore creates what? Better blood flow because of that?
It makes it so that you're less likely to throw a clot.
Okay.
That's why they give them. So people with atrial fibrillation are generally given blood thinners, and they like to give warfarin because warfarin can be controlled. Warfarin is vitamin K dependent. And warfarin, because it's vitamin K dependent, you can raise it up and down, and you can antidote it with vitamin K if you take too much of it.
Is there a natural way to thin your blood? Exercise, probably. I'll bet that's where we're going to go here.
Yes, there are natural ways to thin your blood. The concern about that is they have a standard by which they thin blood. So they measure the standard of blood thinning with the INR, the internal normalized rate, which is a rate of clotting. And so if you get your INR up between 2 and 3, that's considered good blood thinning. You can't really measure that if you're using natural blood thinners or if you're using non-vitamin K-dependent blood thinners. You can't use the INR as a measure. And some people choose to take non-vitamin K-dependent blood thinners, your things that end in glore, like Xarelto and Plavix and Eliquis, and those are all factor 10 dependent. I think it's factor 10A dependent clotting anticoagulants, but they are not vitamin K dependent, so you can't antidote them with vitamin K. You also don't have to worry about how much greens you eat, because there's lots of vitamin K in leafy greens. So the way they do it is they have people eat what is a nice proportion of leafy greens for them, and then they adjust the warfarin dose around that. And they do that as a blood thinner. And they might also give a beta blocker, something. So I'm taking a beta agonist for me to help breathe better. Well, you take the opposite when you're trying to slow the heart rhythm down, a beta blocker. Oh, so if you start to slow the heart rhythm down, you're less likely to have disordered flow. Also, if you take something like losartan, which is an angiotensin II converting enzyme receptor. Anyway, it's another heart medication that can affect how the heart rhythm functions. And so they give these various medications to alter the heart rhythm. Ultimately, what's usually done is they make a determination if they can do some kind of an ablation. So they will determine the part of the heart that's problematic, that's causing the atrial fibrillation, and they'll cauterize it. They'll go in and cauterize it. And before that, they might give a converter, an electrical converter for the heart to help to keep the heart rhythm regular. And so that can be an implant. But in the end, what they want to do is some kind of surgery where they put you into normal sinus rhythm so that you don't have to take the drugs anymore. And that can be done. And it isn't always done successfully, but that is what is done. And so it's very interesting. So people, as they get older, are more likely to have atrial fibrillation. Atrial fibrillation runs in families. You're more likely to have it if you have Hashimoto's thyroiditis. which is an autoimmune thyroid condition. And if you have genetic predispositions and you're a high-level athlete, you're more likely to get it. You may be more likely to get it even if you don't have a predisposition if you're a high-level athlete. A high-level athlete who does a lot of cardio. That's us.
Yeah, yes. That's us.
Yeah. So, so atrial fibrillation in natural medicine, we generally treat it with, like I said, fish oil and hawthorn and magnesium and coenzyme Q10 and perhaps cactus and some other cardiac stabilizing herbs. So anyway, that is what atrial fibrillation is. Hmm. And the end goal is to get it so that you have a normal rhythm so you don't have to take the meds anymore, because the meds are ultimately, they have their issues too. People tend not to feel well on the meds. Warfarin makes you, because it thins your blood too much, it tends to make you cold, tends to make you tired, it tends to affect people's thought processes, tends to make you sleepy. And people just don't feel well on it. And then the drugs that slow your heart down, slow down your blood pressure, tend to make you feel tired as well. So anyway, so it's good to get some good care around atrial fibrillation and figure out a way to get out of the atrial fibrillation, even if it is ultimately some kind of ablation, like an embolization ablation or other kind of ablation, so that the heart rhythm functions normally. So there you have it. Yeah. All right. So we talked about a few cool things. More on what if you have to use MD medicine and how to help this bronchitis that's going around, how to keep warmer, and what to do about AFib. So it's been great talking with you here on Radio Naturopath, here on 91.7 FM WHUS Doors. I will be back next week with more Radio Naturopath here on 91.7 WHUS.